Underworld, Disc 2.
The halt in play has allowed the crowd to rebuild its noise. Russ keeps pausing at the mic to let the sound collect. This is a rumble of a magnitude he has never heard before. You can't call it cheering or rooting. It's a territorial roar. The claim of the ego that separates the crowd from other entities, from political rallies or prison riots, everything outside the walls. Ross nuzzles up to the mic and tries to be calm, although he is very close to speaking in a shout, because this is the only way to be heard. Men clustered on the mound, and the manager waving to the bullpen, and the pitcher walking in, and the pitcher leaving, and the runner from Mueller doing knee bends at third. They are banging on the roof of the booth. Russ says, "So don't go away. Light up that Chesterfield. We're going to stay right here and see how big Ralph Branca will fare." Yes, it is Branca coming through the dampish glow. Branca, who is tall and stalwart, but seems to carry his own hill and dale. He has the aura of a man encumbered. The drooping lids, leaden feet, the thick ridge across the brow. His face is set behind a somber nose, broad-bridged and looming. The stadium police are taking up posts. Look at the man on the upper deck. He is tearing pages out of his copy of Life and dropping them uncrumpled over the rail, letting them fall in a seesaw drift on the bawling fans below. He is moved to do this by the paper falling elsewhere, the contagion of paper. It is giddy and unformulated fun. He begins to ignore the game so he can waft pages over the rail. It brings him into contact with the other paper throwers and with the fans on the lower deck who reach for his pages and catch them. They are all a second force that runs parallel to the game. Not far away, another man feels something pulling at his chest, arms going numb. He wants to sit down, but doesn't know if he can reach an arm back to lower himself to the seat. Heart! My heart! My God! Branca, who is 25, but makes you think he exemplifies ancient toil. By the time he reaches the mound, the stretcher-bearers have managed to get Mueller up the steps and into the clubhouse. The crowd forgets him. They would forget him if he were dead. The noise expands once more. Branca takes the ball, and the men around the mound recede to the fringes. Shore looks at Gleason. He says, "Tell me you want to go home. What happened to Let's Go Home? If we leave now, we can beat the crowd." He says, "I can't visualize it enough, both you crumb bums. You deserve every misery in the book." Jackie looks miserable, all right. He loosens his necktie and undoes the top button of his shirt. He is the only member of the quartet not on his feet. But it isn't the shift in the game that has caused his discomfort. It's the day-long booze and the greasy food. Shore says, "Tell me you want to go home so I can run ahead and hold the car door open and, like, usher you inside." Paper is coming down around the group. Big, slick pages from a magazine. Completely unremarkable in the uproar of the moment. Frank snatches a full-page ad for something called pasteurized processed cheese food, a Borden's product. That's the company with the cow, and there's a color picture of yellowish pressed pulp melting horribly on a hot dog. Frank deadpans the page to Gleason. "Here, this'll help you digest." Jackie sits there like an air traveler in a downdraft. The pages keep falling. Baby food, instant coffee, encyclopedias and cars, waffle irons and shampoos and blended whiskies. Piping Times, an optimistic bounty that carries into the news pages where the nation's farmers record a bumper crop. And the resplendent products, how the dazzle of a Packard car is repeated in the feature story about the art treasures of the Prado. It's all part of the same thing. Rubens, and Titian, and Playtex, and Motorola. And here's a picture of Sinatra himself sitting in a nightclub in Nevada with Ava Gardner, and would you check that cleavage? Frank didn't know he was in this week's life until the page fell out of the sky. He has people who were supposed to tell him these things. He keeps the page and reaches for another to stuff in Gleason's face. Here's a Budweiser ad, pal. In a country that's in a hurry to make the future, the names attached to the products are an enduring reassurance. Johnson & Johnson, and Quaker State, and RCA Victor, and Burlington Mills, and Bristol-Myers, and General Motors. These are the venerated emblems of the burgeoning economy, easier to identify than the names of battlefields or dead presidents. Not that Jackie's in the mood to scan a magazine. He is sunk in deep inertia, a rancid sweat developing, his mouth filled with the foretaste of massive inner shiftings. Bronca takes the last of his warm-up tosses, flicking the glove to indicate a curve. Never mind the details of manner or appearance, the weight-bearing body at rest. Out on the mound he is strong and loose, cutting smoothly out of his windup, a man who wants the ball. Farrillo watching from right field, the stone-cut profile. The bushy-haired man still pacing in the bleachers, moaning and shaking his head. Call the men in the white suits and get them out of here. Talking to himself, head wagging like a street corner zealot with news of some distant affliction dragging ever closer. Sit down, shut up, they tell him. Frank keeps putting pages in Gleason's face. He tells him, eat up, pal. Paper clears the palate. When in steps Thompson. The tall, fleet Scot. Reminding himself as he gets set in the box, see the ball. Wait for the ball. Russ is clutching the mic. Warm water and salt. Gargle, said his mother. Thompson's not sure he sees things clearly. His eyeballs are humming. There's a feeling in his body. He's digging in, settling into his stance, crowd noise packing the sky. And there's a feeling that he has lost the link to his surroundings, alone in all this rowdy dow. See the ball. Watch and wait. He is frankly a little fuddled, is Bobby. It's like the first waking moment of the day, and you don't know whose house you're in. Russ says, Bobby Thompson up there swinging. May's down on one knee in the on-deck circle, half-leaning on his cradled bat, and watching Bronca go into a full wind-up, push-pull, click-click, thinking it's all on him if Thompson fails, the season riding on him. And the jingle plays in his head. It's the radio embrace of the air itself, the mosaic of the air, and it will turn itself off when it's ready. There's an emergency station under the stands, and what the stadium cop has to do is figure out a way to get the stricken man down there without being overrun by a rampant, stomping crowd. The victim looks okay, considering. He's sitting down, waiting for the attendant to arrive with a wheelchair. All right, maybe he doesn't look so good. He looks pale, sick, worried, and infarcted. But he can make a fist and stick out his tongue. And there's not much the cop can do until the wheelchair arrives, so he might as well stand in the aisle and watch the end of the game. Thompson, in his bent stance, chin tucked, waiting. Russ says, one out, last of the ninth. He says, Bronca pitches. Thompson takes a strike called on the inside corner. He lays a heavy decibel on the word strike. He pauses to let the crowd reaction build. Do not talk against the crowd. Let the drama come from them. Those big, rich pages airing down from the upper deck. Lockman stands near second and tries to wish a hit onto Thompson's bat. That may have been the pitch he wanted. Belt high, a shade inside. Won't see one that good again. Russ says, Bobby hitting at 292. He's had a single and a double and drove in the Giants' first run with a long fly to center. Lockman looks across the diamond at home. The double he hit is still a presence in his chest. It's chugging away in there, a body memory that plays the moment over. He is peering into the deltoid opening between the catcher's knees. He sees the fingers dip, the blunt hand make a flapping action up and left. They'll give him the fastball high and tight and come back with the curve away. A pretty two-part scheme. Seems easy and sweet from here. Russ says, Brooklyn leads it 4-2. He says, runner down the line at third, not taking any chances. Thompson thinking it's all happening too fast. Thinking quick hands, see the ball, give yourself a chance. Russ says, Lockman without too big of a lead at second, but he'll be running like the wind if Thompson hits one. In the box seats, J. Edgar Hoover plucks a magazine page off his shoulder where the thing is lighted and stuck. At first he's annoyed that the object has come in contact with his body. Then his eyes fall upon the page. It is a color reproduction of a painting crowded with medieval figures who are dying or dead. A landscape of visionary havoc and ruin. Edgar has never seen a painting quite like this. It covers the page completely and must surely dominate the magazine. Across the red-brown earth, skeleton armies on the march. Men impaled on lances, hung from gibbets, drawn on spoked wheels, fixed to the tops of bare trees. Bodies open to the crows. Legions of the dead forming up behind shields made of coffin lids. Death himself astride a slat-ribbed hack. He is peaked for blood. His scythe held ready as he presses people in haunted swarms toward the entrance of some hell trap. An oddly modern construction that could be a subway tunnel or office corridor. A background of ash skies and burning ships. It is clear to Edgar that the page is from life, and he tries to work up an anger. He asks himself why a magazine called Life would want to reproduce a painting of such lurid and dreadful dimensions. But he can't take his eyes off the page. Russ Hodges says, Branca throws. Gleason makes a noise that is halfway between a sigh and a moan. It is probably a sow, as of rustling surf in some palmy place. Edgar recalls the earlier blowout, Jackie's minor choking fit. He sees a deeper engagement here. He goes out into the aisle and up two steps, separating himself from the imminent discharge of animal, vegetable, and mineral matter. Not a good pitch to hit, up and in, but Thompson swings and tomahawks the ball, and everybody watches. Except for Gleason, who is bent over in his seat, hands locked behind his neck, a creamy strand of slime swinging from his lips. Russ says, "There's a long drive!" His voice has a burst in it, a charge of expectation. He says, "It's going to be..." There's a pause all around him, Pafko racing toward the left field corner. He says, "I believe..." Pafko at the wall. Then he's looking up. People thinking, "Where's the ball?" The scant delay, the stay in time that lasts a hair's breadth. And Cotter standing in section 35, watching the ball come in his direction. He feels his body turn to smoke. He loses sight of the ball when it climbs above the overhang, and he thinks it will land on the upper deck. But before he can smile or shout or bash his neighbor on the arm, before the moment can overwhelm him, the ball appears again, stitches visibly spinning. That's how near it hits, banging at an angle off a pillar, hands flashing everywhere. Russ feels the crowd around him, a shudder passing through the stands, and then he is shouting into the mic, and there is a surge of color and motion, a crash that occurs upward, stadium-wide, hands and faces and shirts, bands of rippling men, and he is outright shouting. His voice has a power he'd thought long gone. It may lift the top of his head like a cartoon rocket. He says, "The Giants win the pennant!" A topspin line drive. He tomahawked the pitch, and the ball had topspin and dipped into the lower deck, and there is Pafko at the 315 sign, looking straight up with his arm braced at the wall and a spate of paper coming down. He says, "The Giants win the pennant!" Yes, the voice is excessive, with a little tickle of hysteria in the upper register. But it is mainly wham and whomp. He sees Thompson capering around first. The hat of the first base coach. The first base coach has flung his hat straight up. He went for a chin-high pitch, and Colcocked it good. The ball started up high and then sank, missing the facade of the upper deck and dipping into the seats below. Pulled in, swallowed up. And the Dodger players stand looking, already separated from the event, staring flat into the shadows between the decks. He says, "The Giants win the pennant!" The crew is whooping. They are answering the roof bangers by beating on the walls and ceiling of the booth. People climbing the dugout roofs and the crowd shaking in its own noise. Branca on the mound in his tormented slouch. He came with a fast ball up, a pitch that's tailing in, and the guy's supposed to take it for a ball. Russ is shouting himself right out of his sore throat, out of every malady and pathology and complaint, and all the pangs of growing up and every memory that is not tender. He says, "The Giants win the pennant!" 4 times. Branca turns and picks up the rosin bag and throws it down, heading toward the clubhouse now. His shoulders aligned at a slant. He begins the long, dead trudge. Paper falling everywhere. Russ knows he ought to settle down and let the mic pick up the sound of the swelling bedlam around him, but he can't stop shouting. There's nothing left of him but shout. He says, "Bobby Thompson hits into the lower deck of the left field stands." He says, "The Giants win the pennant and they're going crazy." He says, "They're going crazy." Then he raises a pure shout, wordless, a holler from the old days. It is fiddling time. It's mountain music on WCKY at 5:30 in the morning. The thing comes jumping right out of him, a jubilation. It might be, "Hey-ho!" Or it might be, "Oh, boy!" shouted backwards. Or it might be something else entirely. Hard to tell when they don't use words. And Thompson's teammates gathering at home plate, and Thompson circling the bases in gamesome leaps, buck-jumping. He is forever Bobby now, a romping boy lost to time. And his breath comes so fast he doesn't know if he can handle all the air that's pouring in. He sees men in a helter-skelter line waiting at the plate to pommel him, his teammates, no better fellows in the world. And there's a look in their faces. They are stunned by a happiness that has collapsed on them, bright-eyed under their caps. He tomahawked the pitch. He hit on top of it. And now his ears are ringing, and there's a numbing buzz in his hands and feet. And Robinson stands behind second, hands on hips, making sure Thompson touches every base. You can almost see Brave Jack grow old. Look at DeRocher spinning. Russ pauses for the first time to catch the full impact of the noise around him. Leo's spinning in the coach's box. The manager stands and spins. He is spinning with his arms spread wide. Maybe it's an ascetic rapture, a thing they do in mosques in Anatolia. People make it a point to register the time. Edgar stands with arms crossed and a level eye on Gleason folded over. Pages dropping all around them. It is a fairly thick issue. Laxatives and antacids, sanitary napkins and corn plasters and dandruff removers. Jackie utters an aquatic bark. It is loud and crude, the hoarse call of some mammal in distress. Then the surge of flannel matter. He seems to be vomiting someone's taupe pajamas. The waist is liquidy smooth in the lingo of Adland, and it is splashing freely on Frank's stout Oxford shoes and fine Lyle hose, and on the soft woven wool of his town and country trousers. The clock atop the clubhouse reads 3:58. Russ has got his face back into the mic. He shouts, "I don't believe it!" He shouts, "I don't believe it!" He shouts, "I do not believe it!" They are coming down to crowd the railings. They are coming from the far ends of the great raid configuration, and they are moving down the aisles and toward the rails. Pafko is out of paper range by now, jogging toward the clubhouse. But the paper keeps falling. If the early paper waves were slightly hostile and mocking, and the middle waves a form of fan commonality, then this last demonstration has a softness, a selfness. It is coming down from all points. Laundry tickets, envelopes swiped from the office. There are crushed cigarette packs and sticky wrap from ice cream sandwiches. Pages from memo pads and pocket calendars. They are throwing faded dollar bills. Snapshots torn to pieces. Ruffled paper swaddles for cupcakes. They are tearing up letters they've been carrying around for years, pressed into their wallets. The residue of love affairs and college friendships. It is happy garbage now. The fans' intimate wish to be connected to the event, unendably, in the form of pocket litter, personal waste, a thing that carries a shadow identity. Rolls of toilet tissue unbolting lyrically in streamers. They are gathered at the netting behind home plate, gripping the tight mesh. Russ is still shouting. He's not yet shouted out. He believes he has a thing that's worth repeating. Saying, "Bobby Thompson hit a line drive into the lower deck of the left field stands, and the place is going crazy." Next thing Cotter knows, he is sidling into the aisle. The area is congested and intense, and he has to pry his way row by row using elbows and shoulders. Nobody much seems to notice. The ball is back there in a mighty pileup of shirts and jackets. The game is way behind him. The crowd can have the game. He's after the baseball now, and there's no time to ask himself why. They hit it in the stands, you go and get it. It's the ball they play with, the thing they rub up and scuff and sweat on. He's going up the aisle through 1,000 pounding hearts. He's prodding and sideswiping. He sees people dipping frantically. It could be apple bobbing in Indiana, only slightly violent. Then the ball comes free, and someone goes after it. The first one out of the pack, a young guy in a scuttling crawl with people reaching for him, trying to grab his jacket, a fistful of trouser ass. He has wiry reddish hair and a college jacket. You know those athletic jackets where the sleeves are one color and leathery looking, and the body is a darker color and probably wool, and these are the college colors of the team. Cotter takes a guess and edges his way along a row that's two rows down from the action. He takes a guess. He anticipates. It's the way you feel something will happen, and then you watch it uncannily come to pass, occurring almost in measured stages so you can see the wheelwork of your idea fitting into place. He cold-cocked the pitch, and the ball shot out there and dipped and disappeared. And Thompson, bounding down on home plate, mobbed by his teammates, who move in shuffled steps with hands extended to keep from spiking each other, and photographers edging near and taking their spread stances, and the first of the fans appearing on the field, the first strays standing wary or whirling about to see things from this perspective, astonished to find themselves at field level, or running right at Thompson, all floppy and demented, milling into the wedge of players at home plate. Frank is looking down at what has transpired. He stands there, hands out, palms up, in awe of muted disgust. That this should happen here, in public, in the high revel of event. He feels a puzzled wonder that exceeds his aversion. He looks down at the back of Jackie's glossy head, and he looks at his own trouser cuffs, flaked in intimate beige, and the spatter across his shoe tops in a strafing pattern, and the gumbo puddle nearby that contains a few laggard gobs of pinkoid stuff from deep in Gleason's gastric sac. And he nods his head and says, "My shoes." And Shore feels offended. He feels a look come into his face that carries the sting of a bad shave, those long-ago mornings of razor pull and cold water. And he looks at Frank and says, "Did you see the homer, at least?" "I saw part and missed part." And Shore says, "Do I want to take the time to ask which part you missed, so we can talk about it on the phone someday?" There are people with their hands in their hair, holding in their brains. Frank persists in looking down. He allows one foot to list to port so he can examine the side of his shoe for vomit marks. These are handcrafted shoes from a narrow street with a quaint name in oldest London. And Shore says, "We just won, unbelievable. And they're ripping up the joint. I don't know whether to laugh, shit, or go blind." And Frank says, "I'm rooting for number one or number three." Russ is still manning the microphone and has one last thing to say and barely manages to get it out. "The Giants won it by a score of 5-4, and they're picking Bobby Thompson up and carrying him off the field." If his voice has an edge of disquiet, it's because he has to get to the clubhouse to do interviews with players and coaches and team officials, and the only way to get out there is to cross the length of the field on foot. And he's already out of breath, out of words, and the crowd is growing over the walls. He sees Thompson carried by a phalanx of men, players and others, mostly others. The players have run for it. The players are dashing for the clubhouse. And he sees Thompson riding off balance on the shoulders of men who might take him right out of the ballpark and into the streets for a block party. Gleason is suspended in wreckage, drained and humped, and he has barely the wit to consider what the shouting's about. The field streaked with people, the hat snatchers, the swift kids who imitate banking aircraft, their spread arms steeply raked. Look at Cotter under a seat. All over the city, people are coming out of their houses. This is the nature of Thompson's Homer. It makes people want to be in the streets, joined with others, telling others what has happened, those few who haven't heard, comparing faces and states of mind. And Russ has a hot mic in front of him, and has to find someone to take it and talk so he can get down to the field and find a way to pass intact through all that mangle. And Cotter is under a seat hand-fighting someone for the baseball. He's trying to get a firmer grip. He's trying to isolate his rival's hand so he can prize the ball away finger by finger. It's a tight little theater of hands and arms, some martial test with formal rules of grappling. The iron seat leg cuts into his back. He hears the earnest breathing of the rival. They are working for advantage, trying to gain position. The rival is blocked off by the seat back. He's face down in the row above with just an arm stuck under the seat. People make it a point to read the time on the clock atop the notched facade of the clubhouse, the high battlement. They register the time when the ball went in. It's a small, tight conflict of fingers and inches, a lifetime of effort compressed into seconds. He gets his hands around the rival's arm just above the wrist. He's working fast, thinking fast. Too much time and people take sides. The rival, the foe, the Ofe, veins stretched and bulged between white knuckles. If people take sides, does Cotter have a chance? Two heart attacks, not one. A second man collapses on the field. A well-dressed fellow, not exactly falling, but letting himself down one knee at a time. Slow and controlled, easing down on his right hand and tumbling dully over. No one takes this for a rollick. The man is not the type to do dog tricks in the dirt. And Cotter's hands around the rival's arm, twisting in opposite directions, burning the skin. It's called an Indian burn, remember? One hand grinding one way, the other going the other, twisting hard, working fast. There's a pause on the rival's breathing. He is pausing to note the pain. He fairly croons his misgivings now. And Cotter feels the arm jerk and the fingers lift from the ball. Thompson, thrusting down off the shoulders of the men who carry him, beating down, pulling away from grabby hands. He sees players watching intently from the clubhouse windows. And Cotter holds the rival's arm with one hand and goes for the ball with the other. He sees it begin to roll past the seat leg, wobbling on the textured surface. He sort of traps it with his eye and sends out a ladling hand. The ball rolls in a minutely crooked path into the open. The action of his hand is as old as he is. It seems he has been sending out this hand for one thing or another since the minute he shot out of infancy. Everything he knows is contained in the splayed fingers of this one bent hand. Heart! My heart! The whole business under the seat has taken only seconds. Now he's backing out, moving post-haste. He's got the ball. He feels it hot and buzzy in his hand. A sense of people grudgingly getting out of his way. Making way, but not too quickly. Dead-eyes sidewalk faces. The ball is damp with the heat and sweat of the rival's hand. Cotter's arm hangs lank at his side, and he empties out his face, scareder now than he was when he went over the turnstile, but determined to look cool and blank, and going down the rows by stepping over seat backs and fitting himself between bodies and walking on seats when it is convenient. Look at the ushers locking arms at the wrists and making a sedan seat for the cardiac victim and hauling him off to the station under the grandstand. One glance back at the area above, he allows himself a glance and sees the rival getting to his feet. The man stands out, white-shirted and hulking. And it's not the college boy he thought it might be, the guy in the varsity jacket who'd been scrambling for the ball. And the man catches his eye. This is not what Cotter wants. This is damage to the cause. He made a mistake looking back. He allowed himself a glance, a sidewise flash, and now he's caught in the man's hard glare. The raised seams of the ball are pulsing in his hand. Their eyes meet in the spaces between rocking bodies, between faces that jut and the broad backs of shouting fans. Celebration all around him. But he is caught in the man's gaze, and they look at each other over the crowd and through the crowd, and it is Bill Watterson, with his shirt stained and his hair all punished and sprung. Good neighbor Bill, flashing a cutthroat smile. The dead have come to take the living. The dead in winding sheets, the regimented dead on horseback, the skeleton that plays a hurdy-gurdy. Edgar stands in the aisle, fitting together the two facing pages of the reproduction. People are climbing over seats, calling hoarsely toward the field. He stands with the pages in his face. He hadn't realized he was seeing only half the painting until the left-hand page drifted down, and he got a glimpse of rust-brown terrain and a pair of skeletal men pulling on bell ropes. The page brushed against a woman's arm and spun into Edgar's God-fearing breast. Thompson is out in center field now, dodging fans who come in rushes and jumps. They jump against his body. They want to take him to the ground, show him snapshots of their families. Edgar reads the copy block on the matching page. This is a 16th-century work done by a Flemish master, Peter Bruegel, and it is called The Triumph of Death. A nervy title, methinks. But he is intrigued. He admits it. The left-hand page may be even better than the right. He studies the tumbril filled with skulls. He stands in the aisle and looks at the naked man pursued by dogs. He looks at the gaunt dog nibbling the baby in the dead woman's arms. These are long, gaunt, starveling hounds. They are war dogs, hell dogs, boneyard hounds beset by parasitic mites, by dog tumors and dog cancers. Dear germ-free Edgar, the man who has an air filtration system in his house to vaporize specks of dust, he finds a fascination in cankers, lesions, and rotting bodies, so long as his connection to the source is strictly pictorial. He finds a second dead woman in the middle ground, straddled by a skeleton. The positioning is sexual, unquestionably. But is Edgar sure it's a woman bestraddled, or could it be a man? He stands in the aisle, and they're all around him cheering, and he has the pages in his face. The painting has an instancy that he finds striking. Yes, the dead fall upon the living. But he begins to see that the living are sinners. the card players, the lovers who dally. He sees the king in an ermine cloak with his fortune stashed in hogshead drums. The dead have come to empty out the wine gourds, to serve a skull on a platter to gentlefolk at their meal. He sees gluttony, lust, and greed. Edgar loves this stuff. Edgar, Jedgar, admit it, you love it. It causes a bristling of his body here. Skeletons with wispy dicks. The dead beating kettle drums. The sackcloth dead slitting a pilgrim's throat. The meat-blood colors and masked bodies, this is a census-taking of awful ways to die. He looks at the flaring sky and the deep distance out beyond the headlands on the left-hand page. Death elsewhere. Conflagration in many places. Terror universal. The crows, the ravens in silent glide. The raven perched on the white nag's rump, black and white forever. And he thinks of a lonely tower standing on the Kazakh test site. The tower armed with the bomb, and he can almost hear the wind blowing across the Central Asian steppes, out where the enemy lives in long coats and fur caps, speaking that old weighted language of theirs, liturgical and grave. What secret history are they writing? There is the secret of the bomb, and there are the secrets that the bomb inspires, things even the director cannot guess. A man whose own sequestered heart holds every festering secret in the Western world, because these plots are only now evolving. This is what he knows, that the genius of the bomb is printed not only in its physics of particles and rays, but in the occasion it creates for new secrets. For every atmospheric blast, every glimpse we get of the bared force of nature, that weird, peeled eyeball exploding over the desert, for every one of these, he reckons 100 plots go underground to spawn and scheme. And what is the connection between us and them? How many bundled links do we find in the neural labyrinth? It's not enough to hate your enemy. You have to understand how the two of you bring each other to deep completion. The old dead fucking the new. The dead raising coffins from the earth. The hillside dead tolling the old rugged bells that clang for the sins of the world. He looks up for a moment. He takes the pages from his face. It is a wrenching effort. And looks at the people on the field. Those who are happy and dazed. Those who run around the bases calling out the score. The ones who are so excited they won't sleep tonight. Those whose team has lost. The ones who taunt the losers. The fathers who will hurry home and tell their sons what they've seen. The husbands who will surprise their wives with flowers and chocolate-covered cherries. The fans pressed together at the clubhouse steps, chanting the players' names. The fans having fistfights on the subway going home. The screamers and berserkers. The old friends who meet by accident out near second base. Those who will light the city with their bliss. Cotter walks at a normal pace in the after-school light. He goes past rows of tenements down 8th Avenue with a small, solemn hop in his stride, a kind of endless, levered up and down. And Bill is positioned off his shoulder, maybe 30 yards back. He sees the power of prayer sign and carries the ball in his right hand and rubs it up several times, and looks back and sees the college boy in the two-tone jacket fall in behind Bill, the guy who was involved in the early scuffle for the ball. Bill has lost his buckaroo grin. He barely shows an awareness that Cotter exists, a boy who walks the earth in high-top kids. Cotter's body wants to go, but if he starts running at this point, what we have is a black kid running in a mainly white crowd, and he's being followed by a pair of irate whites yelling thief or grief or something. They walk down the street, three secret members of some organized event. Bill calls out, "Hey, Cotter, buddy, come on. We won this game together." Many people have disappeared into cars or down the subways. They're swarming across the walkway on the bridge to the Bronx, but there are still enough bodies to disrupt traffic in the streets. The mounted police are out, high-riding and erect, appearing among the cars as levitated beings. "Hey, Cotter, I had my hand on that ball before you did." Bill says this good-natured. He laughs when he says it, and Cotter begins to like the man all over again. Car horns are blowing all along the street, noises of joy and mutual salute. The college boy says, "I think it's time I got in this. I'm in this, too. I was the first one to grab a hold of the ball. Actually, long before either one of you. Somebody hit it out of my hand. I mean, if we're talking about who was first..." Cotter's watching the college boy speak, looking back diagonally. He sees Bill stop, so he stops. Bill is stopping for effect. He wants to stop so he can measure the college boy, look him up and down in an itemizing way. He's taking in the two-tone jacket, the tight red hair. He's taking in the whole boy, the entire form and structure of the college boy's status as a land animal with a major brain. And he says, "What?" That's all, a hard, sharp "what." And he stands there agape, his body gone slack in a comic dumbness that's pervaded with danger. He says, "Who the hell are you, anyway? What are you doing here? Do I know you?" Cotter watches this, entertained by the look on the college boy's face. The college boy thought he was part of a team. It's us against him. Now his eyes don't know where to go. Bill says, "This is between my buddy Cotter and me. Personal business, understand? We don't want you here. You're ruining our fun. And if I have to make it any plainer, there's going to be a family sitting down to dinner tonight, minus a loved one." Bill resumes walking, and so does Cotter. He looks back to see the college boy following Bill for a number of paces, unsurely, and then falling out of step and beginning to fade down the street and into the crowd. Bill looks at Cotter and grins narrowly. It is a wolfish sort of look with no mercy in it. He carries his suit jacket clutched and bunched in his hand, wadded up like something he might want to throw. With advancing dark, the field is taking on a deeper light. The grass is incandescent. It has a heat and sheen. People go running past, looking half ablaze, and Russ Hodges moves with the tentative steps of some tourist at a grand bazaar, trying to hand-shuffle through the crowd. Some ushers are lifting a drunk off the first baseline, and the man warps himself into a baggy mass and shakes free and begins to run around the bases in his oversized raincoat with long belt trailing. Russ makes his way through the infield and dance steps into an awkward jog that makes him feel ancient and extraneous. And he thinks of the ballplayers of his youth, the men with redneck monikers whose endeavors he followed in the papers every day. Epa Rixey and Hod Eller and old Ivy Wingo. And there's a silly grin pasted across his face because he's a 41-year-old man with a high fever, and he is running across a ball field to conduct a dialogue with a pack of athletes in their underwear. He says to someone running near him, "I don't believe it. I still don't believe it." Out in dead center, he sees the clubhouse windows catch the trigger glint of flash bulbs going off inside. He hears a shrill cheer and turns and sees the raincoat drunk sliding into third base. Then he realizes the man running alongside is Al Edelstein, his producer. Al shouts, "Do you believe it?" "I do not believe it," says Russ. They shake hands on the run. Al says, "Look at these people." He is shouting and gesturing, waving a Cuban cigar. "It's like, I don't know what. If you don't know what, then I don't know what." "Save the voice," says Al. "The voice is dead and buried. It went to heaven on a sunbeam." "I'll tell you one thing's for certain, old pal. We'll never forget today." "Glad you're with me, buddy." The running men shake hands again. They're deep in the outfield now, and Russ feels an ache in every joint. The clubhouse windows catch the flash of the popping bulbs inside. In the box seats across the field, Edgar sets his hat at an angle on his head. It's a dark gray Homburg that brings out the nicely sprinkled silver at his temples. He has the Bruegel folded neatly in his pocket and will take these pages home to study further. Thousands remain in the stands, not nearly ready to leave, and they watch the people on the field, aimless eddies and stirrings, single figures sprinting out of crowds. Edgar sees someone dangling from the wall in right center field. These men who drop from the high walls like to hang for a while before letting go. They hit the ground and crumple and get up slowly. But it's the static drama of the dangled body that Edgar finds compelling, the terror of second thoughts. Gleason is on his feet now, crapulous Jack, all rosy and afloat, ready to lead his buddies up the aisle. He rails at Frank. "Nothing personal, pal, but I wonder if you realize you're smelling up the ballpark. Talk about stinko. I can smell you even with Shore on the premises. Usually with Shore around, blind people are tapping for garbage cans in their path." Shore thinks this is funny. Light comes into his eyes and his face goes crinkly. He loves the insults, the slurs and taunts, and he stands there beaming with balloon-head love. It's the highest thing that can pass between men of a certain mind, the stand-up scorn that carries their affection. But what about Frank? He says, "It's not my stink, it's your stink, pal. Just happens I'm the one that's wearing it." Says Gleason, "Hey, don't think you're the first friend I ever puked on. I puked on better men than you. Consider yourself honored. This is a form of flattery I extend to nearest and dearest." Here he waves his cigarette. "But don't think I'm riding in any limousine that has you in it." They march toward the exit ramp with Edgar going last. He turns toward the field on an impulse and sees another body dropping from the outfield wall, a streaky length of limbs and hair and flapping sleeves. There is something apparitional in the moment, and it chills and excites him, and sends his hand into his pocket to touch the bleak pages hidden there. The crowd is thinning quickly now, and Cotter goes past the last of the mounted police down around 148th Street. "Hey, Cotter, now let's be honest. You snatched it out of my hand. A clear case of snatch and run. But I'm willing to be reasonable. Let's talk turkey. What do you say to $10 in crisp bills? That's a damn fair offer. $12. You can buy a ball and glove for that. That's what you think. All right, whatever it takes. Let's find a store and go in. A fielder's glove and a baseball. You got sporting goods stores around here? Hell, we won the game of our lives. There's cause for celebration. The ball's not for sale. Not this ball." Bill says, "Let me tell you something, Cotter." Then he pauses and grins. "You got quite a grip, you know. My arm needs attention in a big way. You really put the squeeze on me." "Lucky I didn't bite. I was thinking about it." Bill seems delighted at the way Cotter has entered the spirit of the moment. The side streets are weary with uncollected garbage and broken glass, with the odd plundered car squatting flat on its axle and men who stand in doorways completely a dream. Bill runs toward Cotter. He takes four sudden running steps, heavy and overstated, arms spread wide, and a movie growl rolling from his throat. Cotter sees it as a joke, but not until he has run into the street and done a loop around a passing car. They smile at each other across the traffic. "I looked at you scrunched up in your seat, and I thought I'd found a pal. This is a baseball fan, I thought, not some delinquent in the streets. You seem to be dead set on disappointing me, Cotter. Buddies sit down together and work things out." The streetlights are on. They're walking briskly now, and Cotter isn't sure who was first to step up the pace. He feels a pain in his back where the seat leg was digging in. "Now tell me what it's going to take to separate you from that baseball, son." Cotter doesn't like the tone of this. "I want that cotton-picking ball." Cotter keeps walking. Hey, Goofus, I'm talking to you. You maybe think this is some cheapo entertainment. String the guy along. You can talk all you want, Cotter says. The ball's not yours. It's mine. I'm not selling it or trading it. A car comes veering off the avenue, and Cotter stops to let it go by. Then he feels something shift around him. There's a ripple in the pavement, or the air, and a scant second in a woman's face nearby. Her eyes shift to catch what's happening behind him. He turns to see Bill coming wide and fast and arm-pumping. It seems awfully heavy traffic for a baseball. The color coming into Bill's face, the shiny fabric at his knees. He has a look that belongs to someone else entirely, a man out of another experience, desperate and propelled. Cotter stands there for one long beat. He wastes a head fake, then starts to run down the empty side street with Bill right on his neck and reaching. He cuts sharp and ducks away, skidding to his knees and wheeling on his right hand, the ball hand, pressing the ball hard in the tar and using it to pivot. Bill goes past him in a drone of dense breath, a formal hum that is close to speech. Cotter sees him stop and turn. He is skewed with rage, face bloated and quirked. A sleeve hangs down from the jacket in his hand and brushes softly on the ground. Cotter runs back up to the avenue with the sound of rustling breath behind him. They are past the ballpark crowd. This is unmixed Harlem here. All he has to do is get to the corner, to people and lights. He sees barroom neon and bedsheets strung across a lot. He sees fresh-killed chickens from the farm. He reads the sign, or maybe gathers it whole, and there's an odd, calm completion in it, a gesturing of safety. Two women step aside when he gets near. They glance past him to his pursuit, and he notes the alertness in their faces, the tapering of attention. Bill is close, banging the asphalt in his businessman's shoes. Cotter goes south on the avenue and runs half a block, and then he turns and does a caper. He does a physical jape, running backwards for a stretch, high-stepping, mocking, showing Bill the baseball. He's a cut-up in a sour state. He holds the ball chest-high and turns it in his fingers, which isn't easy when you're running. He rotates the ball on its axis, spins it slowly over and around, showing the 216 raised red cotton stitches. Don't tell me you don't love this move. The maneuver makes Bill slow down. He looks at Cotter backpedaling, doing a dance man's strut, but he doesn't detect an opening here, because the maneuver makes him realize where he is. The fact that Cotter's not scared. The fact that he's parading the baseball. Bill stops completely, but is too smart to look around. Best to limit your purview to straight ahead, because you don't know who might be looking back at you. And the more enlightened he becomes, the more open grows the space for Cotter's anger. He doesn't really know how to show it. This is the second time today he has taunted someone, but he doesn't feel the spunky rush of dodging the cop. The high heart of the gate crash is a dimness here. He's muddled and wrung out, and can't get his badass glare to function. So he stands there flat-foot and looks at Bill with people walking by and noticing and not noticing, and he spins the ball back up and over the back of his hand and catches it skipping off his wrist with a dip and twist of the same hand, like, fuck you, mister, who you messing with? He looks at Bill, a flushed and panting man who has vainly chased along a railroad track for the 509. Then he turns his back and walks slowly down the street. He begins to think about the game's amazing end. What could not happen actually happened. He wants to get home, sit quiet, let it live again, let the home run roll over him, soaking his body with a kind of composure, the subtle pleasure that comes after the thing itself. A man calls from a window to a man on a stoop.
Hey, baby, I hear she put your nightstick in a sling.
Cotter turns here, looks there, feeling a sense of placeness that grows more familiar. He sees a kid he knows, but doesn't stop to show him the ball or brag on the game. He feels the pain from the seat leg. He sees a street corner shouter making a speech, a tall man in a rag suit with bicycle clips nipping his pants at the ankles. He feels a little bring down working in his mind. He sees four guys from a local gang, the Alhambras, and he crosses the street to avoid them and then crosses back. He gets to his street and goes up the front steps and into the sour air of his building, and he feels the little bring down of fading light that he has felt a thousand times before. Shit, man, I don't want to go to school tomorrow. Russ Hodges stands on an equipment trunk, trying to describe the scene in the clubhouse. And he knows he's making no sense. And the players who climb up on the trunk to talk to him are making no sense. And they are all talking in unnatural voices, failed voices, creaturely night squeaks. Others are pinned to their lockers by reporters and family members and club officials, and they can't get to the liquor and beer located on a table in the middle of the room. Russ holds the mic over his head and lets the noise sweep in, and then lowers the mic and says another senseless thing. Thompson goes out on the clubhouse veranda to respond to the sound of his chanted name, and they are everywhere. They are on the steps with stadium cops keeping them in check. And there are thousands more, spread dense across the space between jutting bleacher walls, many arms extended toward Thompson. They are pointing or imploring or making victory fists or stating a desire to touch. Men in suits and hats down there, and others hanging over the bleacher wall above Bobby, reaching down, half falling over the edge, some very near to touching him. Al says, the producer, "Great job today, Rush, buddy.
We did something great just by being here.
What a feeling.
I'd smoke a cigar, but I might die.
But what a feeling," Al says.
"We sure pulled something out of a hat, all of us together. Damn, I just realized.
What's a ball game to make us feel like this?"
"I have to go back. Left my top coat in the booth."
"We need a walk to settle us down."
"We need a long walk."
"That's the only coat you've ever loved," says Al. They leave by way of the Dodger clubhouse, and there's Bronca, all right. The first thing you see, stretched face down on a flight of six steps, feet touching the floor. He's still in uniform except for shirt and cap. He wears a wet undershirt, and his head is buried in his crossed arms on the top step. Al and Russ speak to a few of the men who remain. They talk quietly and try not to look at Bronca. They look, but tell themselves they aren't. Next to Bronca, a coach sits in full uniform, but hatless, smoking a cigarette. His name is Cookie. No one wants to catch Cookie's eye. Al and Russ talk quietly to a few more men, and all of them together try not to look at Bronca. The steps from the Dodger clubhouse are nearly clear of people. Thompson has gone back inside, but there are fans still gathered in the area, waving and chanting. The two men begin to walk across the outfield, and Al points to the place in the left field stands where the ball went in. "Mark the spot, like where Lee surrendered to Grant or some such thing." Russ thinks this is another kind of history. He thinks they will carry something out of here that joins them all in a rare way, that binds them to a memory with protective power. People are climbing lampposts on Amsterdam Avenue, tooting car horns in Little Italy. Isn't it possible that this mid-century moment enters the skin more lastingly than the vast shaping strategies of eminent leaders, generals steely in their sunglasses, the mapped visions that pierce our dreams? Russ wants to believe a thing like this keeps us safe in some undetermined way. This is the thing that will pulse in his brain come old age and double vision and dizzy spells. The surge sensation. The leap of people already standing. That bolt of noise and joy when the ball went in. This is the people's history, and it has flesh and breath that quicken to the force of this old safe game of ours. And fans at the polo grounds today will be able to tell their grandchildren. There'll be the gassy old men leaning into the next century and trying to convince anyone willing to listen, pressing in with medicine breath, that they were here when it happened. The raincoat drunk is running the bases. They see him round first, his hands paddling the air to keep him from drifting into right field. He approaches second in a burst of coattails and limbs and untied shoelaces and swinging belt. They see he is going to slide, and they stop and watch him leave his feet. All the fragments of the afternoon collect around his airborne form. Shouts, bat cracks, full bladders, and stray yawns. The sand-grain manyness of things that can't be counted. It is all falling indelibly into the past.
This ends Disc 2.